What about translations? You're pretty much trilingual.
I speak four languages, but French is not that good.
And La Reina del Cine Roma, your novel, you wrote in Portuguese.
I wrote in Portuguese.
Your cuentos, you also wrote in Portuguese.
Yeah, the short stories I wrote in more traditional Portuguese, more normative Portuguese, if you like. And the novel I wrote in street Portuguese, from the streets of Bahia, especially. Which is curious, because the first edition of the book actually came out in Portugal. And it's full of footnotes, because there's a lot of things that can't at all be understood in Portugal. When they did the Brazilian edition, it still has footnotes, because many of the things are local to Bahia. So translation, yeah, we were talking about this. Did we talk that offline or online? The idea of the local and the global against the grains of globalization.
We talked that when you weren't recording. So.
Okay. One of the things that's a hypothesis is that there is sort of a tendency, sort of a global phenomenon of literature that reivindicates the local, that against the grain of globalization that tries to homogenize the world, tries to portray the local with all its richness of its individuality. And yet this intention of portraying the local is either a global phenomenon or has hints at being a global phenomenon in the sense that it's happening in many places. And if this is so, that in the face of a globalization that is destroying memory, that is destroying realities, that is destroying life, lifestyles and ways of seeing the world and ways of perceiving the world, so ways of being in the world, if there's this movement to demolish all of this, and there's this counter movement of saying no, there is a wealth of these realities of being different. At the same time, there's a need to translate, to interconnect these realities, these different realities. Because one of the tools that these authors of these local literatures are using is language. And to go back to the local language that in many cases, for example in Latin America, has been marginalized and even criminalized.
And it's often oral, it's not written.
Of course, yeah. And there's also the issue of orality and how orality maintains the roots and how many of these populations have had very little access to the written word. And this is La Ciudad Letrada, the lettered city, as part of the foundation, the colonial foundation of Latin America, is as a means of maintaining power within a handful of people, the lettered people. And sort of an interesting digression, if you don't mind. 15 days after Christopher Columbus sailed to discover America, though he never realized that he had discovered anything. 15 days after he sailed, Antonio de Nebrija handed the Queen a grammar of Castilian. And in the preface, he basically says, this is a weapon of conquest. This is the first grammar. There have been previous grammars, but what the previous grammars did, Sanskrit, for example, was try to define how a no longer living language worked, or a language that only a few elite people spoke. So it described the language. What Nebrija did was to define how a language should be written and spoken given the diversity of vernacular Castilian. This is an imposition. This is how it should be. This is the right way. And of course, nobody at all in Spain spoke that way. This is 15 days after Christopher Columbus sailed to America, and this is one of the tools of conquest in the Americas.
It was also one of the tools of conquest in Europe, of the smaller cultures, the smaller languages, mm-hmm. the vernaculars, the richness of much European culture.
Of course, I mean, that is one of the purposes of his grammar. Is in Spain there was a huge diversity of vernacular. He saw that as a big problem, as a source of lack of control, not within Spain itself and in its and outside as an empire. But this is very significant because this is how Latin America is born, you know, in the conquests. And this is what we inherit. And this goes hand in hand with educational systems, especially designed in the 19th century, that have a view of the poor and the inferior races, in quotes, as potentially troublesome. And two very distinct sorts of educational systems, one for children of the middle class, of the elite, and one for the rest. And one of them is an education, the other one is a method of control. So in this perspective, for these populations who have been systematically excluded from what has been defined as the only correct way to speak, to take this, what has been a weapon of exclusion, and to turn it around and inject it with their own vernacular, which everybody tells them is wrong, to create literature against the grain and describe and portray realities that are also marginalized and excluded. You know, this is a very interesting phenomenon, both literally and politically. Now, if this happens, and this is a phenomenon that happens not only in Brazil but in many places, then the great need for translation so that these realities can communicate with each other and transform this, and again, I'm seeing it from two perspectives, one from the literary perspective and the aesthetic perspective, and the other one from the political perspective, and I think both of them go together. This communication allowing both a development of aesthetic thinking as well as development of a transnational political subject against the grain of everything that's going on. The need for translation is fundamental.
So if your book was to be translated into English, then it would have to be translated into a very vernacular English. It might mean that the English language gets liberated through the translation of Latin American.
I think so. In fact, someone told me that that's what he felt when he read my translation to Spanish book, that it sort of liberated the language here.
That Portuguese liberated Spanish, yeah. Mexican Spanish.
Because the way I translated that, and I say that in the preface of the book, the first attempt was, you know, if you have a vernacular, well, you have to translate it into a different vernacular. And I translated it into a Mexico City barrio language. And it sounded good, but it didn't make any sense, you know, because these local languages are not just ways of saying the same thing, you know, they're ways of thinking the world differently, of seeing the world differently. And so all of these expressions have a feeling attached to them, have a worldview attached to them. And so when you translate into a different worldview, well, you lose the original world, you know, it doesn't work. So what I tried to do was create a hybrid that nobody speaks except the characters in my novel, where you feel a lot of the Portuguese, a lot of the words are actually left in Portuguese. Many of them are invented words that sort of blend the Portuguese and the Spanish, and also the construction of the sentences. Nobody would ever speak that way in Spanish, but that in a way maintains a rhythm that has to do with how people speak in Bahia. In Bahia, people speak sort of singing, sort of dancing, and slowly, and you have this tropical slowness, musical feel to it. How do you maintain that in Spanish? I think that is possible in Spanish because there is a great similarity in the languages. I think that should be done for a translation to English. How to do it? It would be extremely difficult. But yes, find ways of liberating the language. Play with it. Go beyond the limits of what we're used to.
When you were talking about globalization, there is other models of globalization, and that is precisely the embrace of difference and cultural encounters.
Yeah, it's not only the acceptance of difference; it is a politicization of difference. It's transforming difference into a political tool for transformation of the world. The Zapatista idea has to do with the creation of autonomous spaces within local identities, deepening these identities in a way that is not exclusive, excluding of the others.
Exclusionary.
In a way that this local reality, with everything that it involves, especially its worldview, be used in order to develop these autonomous spaces outside of the functioning of the capitalist system. That's what the Zapatistas have done brilliantly with an autonomous education system, an autonomous health system, an autonomous government, an autonomous legal system, autonomous forms of economy. But that's not enough, and they realize it. In order for this world to change, I mean, they can resist and they can live in their own world with increasing difficulties, but that's not going to change the world. In order to create a really, truly systemic change, a traditional revolution is no longer possible. The only viable alternative is that, creating these autonomous spaces everywhere, but then linking them together in order for this network of autonomies transform itself into a global political subject capable of building an alternative reality, not only resisting or combating the hegemonic reality, but building an alternative reality and making it grow so much that it overtakes what is being imposed on us. And it has to do with everything that we've been talking about in terms of literature and linking and translating it.
It all becomes part of knowledge, literature, the way we talk to each other.